listening to atoms, motion, and the void. In the center of town, you can often see him, Flip Hackery. He stands in the middle of the road, between the yellow writing paper lines of the median strip, like a misspelled word. Amid streets, he calls it, and he eats his lunch from his pockets as the cars pass, like some kind of self-sufficient pigeon. If the local constable should arrive, Flip will simply continue to the other side of the road, as though having finally discovered a window in the hectic traffic through which to pass. He's considered something of his own brand of nuisance, something between a menace and a ne'er-do-well, somewhere in the territory of an escaped crackpot or local loony. But like a peculiar wild neighborhood dog, Flip manages to bother just about everyone, just about equally, and in just about the same, subtly irksome way. Flip is probably 50. He has that ragged, youthful look of an old man boy, which always means 50 to me. He has a preference for all-encompassing blue jeans outfits and renegade fluorescent bandanas, and on his feet he wears the most enormous clomping boots. Boots that many anti-flip people like to claim are ski boots, but they are not. They are just gargantuan and horrid, rotten old lace-ups. In town, especially in the Lemon Cafe and the Yarn Shop and Dondero's Rock Store, there is often thunderous weather as far as Flip Hackery, for the owners of these establishments are forced to see him daily from their windows, unfluctuating on the yellow lines, in the middle of the street, in the middle of the day, like a traffic conductor who has just stumbled into an existential crisis and will no longer regulate the tide of cars. But though he is done, he cannot leave. Flip was not always an amid-streetsman. He occasionally explains this to small, intercessionary groups in a reasonable and polite language, using his own specialty dialect, which is part Southern and part French, as though he learned to speak in the forest, using only the works of Tennessee Williams and Victor Hugo. So he knows his amid-street stewardship is peculiar and unwanted. He's not saying it's not, or that he doesn't understand the contempt. But he begs for their forgiveness, their forbearance, their permission. It's just something he likes to do. 12 years ago, Flip will explain, after he'd completed a phase of making wooden ship dioramas, many of which, he would say, went on to star in different storefronts here and there in Lemon, none of which I charged for, and some of which I'm sure are responsible for a sale or two, although that cannot be verified by you, me, or the anthill. So, Hobbilis, Flip had gone to Dondero's and picked out a handful of semi-precious stones, imagining he might be able to launch a new hobby with the almost gems, to follow along after his wooden ship scene hobby, which he suddenly found himself despising. And it was then, while crossing the main street, that his right ankle had suddenly broken. He had stepped wrong, probably, was pencil-thin and malnourished, but he claims the ankle break was the result of poor foot protection. Right there in the street, on account of poor foot protection. Thus, he instantly developed a preference for gargantuan boots. Even his blue jean outfits serve as a kind of passive street armor, preventing scrapes should he fall, and generally restricting his bones with the tightness of an ace bandage. But having broken his ankle, he found himself stranded in the middle of the ocean of Main Street. He thought to call out for help, but had long made it his special habit of being self-sufficient. He hated the idea of saying the word help, and hated even more the idea of saying it loudly. But he was considering it then, for he was worried his other ankle might break from its obvious poor footwear condition if he tried to hop. But even if he wanted to call out, he first would have to wait for the assembly of cars to pass so that his voice might be heard above their crinkly whirry-whoosh. So he waited on one foot and waited, and was in fact forced to wait, for the longest, most impolite barricade of cars the town of Lemmon has ever seen. In fact, it was a funeral for a local luminary, and there were over 180 cars that stretched for more than 2 miles, and they were like blind animals swimming down the road and would stop for no one and nothing. And so Flip was stuck with his broken ankle in his self-reliance at the edge of the longest funeral procession the local world had ever known. Yet he claims it was only a matter of seconds, as numbered and semi-precious as the stones in his hand, that Flip Hackery discovered the deep, abiding pleasure of standing amid street. "It's dangerous, but it's safe," he liked to point out to judging onlookers. "It gets you right smack in the middle of the wind face and the slip and slide of the sharp blade of the world, as though the whole civilization were, with each passing car, trying to butcher you right then and there." This was more literally true than even that, for standing in the street for so long had served to paint a target on his blue-jeaned body, and there was increasingly in town a club of persons who, upon seeing his big-footed, self-stalled, irritatingly all-blue self standing in the center strip, would gun their engines and try to mow him down. They didn't exactly want to hit him, but rather to shove him off the public road, as though standing still where he was itself become a newly invented mode of trespass. Now this is not a story that ends in a lesson for all about the perils of flip-hacking, as we call any peculiar and or bothersomely quiet activity here in town, but more so as a memo on an unconscious alteration that has come to almost everyone in town. I noticed it, of course, in myself at first, a gentle tug of curiosity that somewhat padded my commutes from one side of the street to the other. I told myself that my dawdling was a just-to-see-what-it-was sort of experiment. I wanted to know what Flip Hackery was guzzling there in the middle of the road, what he was, in a way, writing in the yellow lines of the median strip. But so it is that if you ever come to Lemmon, you will see a town with an unexpected and rather new rhythm of street transit. There's a general tendency to linger and loiter in the middle of the road, and there is now much waving on of cars and much idle looking about. Not for long, but perhaps for as many semi-precious seconds as Flip Hackery has stones. Flip Hackery, who told us all in a way we didn't want to hear, that there was a measure of unexplored life to be had where no one else had ever had it before. And is there, you might wonder, some electric thrill or emulsion of valour in standing amid street? You will just have to find out yourself, for it is impossible, once you've seen or heard about Flip Hackery's amid-streetness, to continue to fail to explore the great adventure that might be afoot among the stampede of wild cars. I heard one of the Goose Hollow girls say that some things become easier when they get harder. I was in the large local grocery store, the Food Hanger it's called, and there's a slogan image on the grandly lettered sign of a biplane made of fruit slices and chunks of vegetable. The plane's body is a carton of milk, and the wings are a kind of cracker. So I was there fetching a can of soup when I came upon the Goose Hollow sisters in the dog food aisle. I should describe them. Firstly, they are very old as I am, and they are the closest thing I have ever seen to the highly opposed, divergently cruel, cliché characters from a children's storybook. One is tall, one is wide, one is short, and each one is more awful than the next. Ima, or Imer, as the other two call her, is tall and icicle-like. Her left hand stays permanently fanned across her chest in a kind of ongoing distaste for all things in existence. This repulsion is further enhanced by her nearly closed eyes, which imply that the world is too disappointing to be granted wider passage. She speaks and whispers, and strangely, for her haughtiness would suggest an unfamiliarity with anything so coarse, she frequently curses or swears a quiet oath. Though self-styled in a regal fashion, and always wearing a long dark dress studded with jewels, Ima has in fact spent her entire life tagging along after her sisters. Though children consider all the Goose Hollow sisters to be witches, they are especially wary of Ima, who seems in the perpetual utterance of some dark incantation. Emma, or Emma as they call her, seems on initial meeting to be the kindest of the three. With her rosy face and bright dresses and dragging scarves, she does not pounce or curse as her sisters do, but instead stares and smiles and will only call out her brutal verdict at the end of any meeting. Emma is round and busy as a butter churn and keeps them in food and clothes and drives the other two around, fashioning a strange creature for herself, both boss and slave. The third sister, Bernice, or Bim, as she is known, is their inquisitorial narrator and general spokesperson. As Ima whispers and swears, and Emma stares and smiles, the child-sized Bim runs roughshod over all intermediaries. Her cruelty, however direct in theory, takes a roundabout route via some trick of her voice, and her condemnations arrive as though over some distant loudspeaker. But despite hearing her insults, there was always a feeling that you were just daydreaming her attack. So impossible and black and cleverly unclose was her ventriloquism. "And here he is," Bim said, as I turned down the dog food aisle, "with his damned single can of broth, as though the food hanger must be bothered to prevent his extinction by permitting him to hold up the line with his dirty, leaky pen. Look at his ink-stained shirt and his mouldy turtle-shell checkbook, all sealed shut from a life crushed under his backside, and his arthritic penmanship and ponderous hand that I regularly witness move as slowly as Satan's spit from the bottom of the first letter to the top. Is it so hard to write an S? Is it so difficult to have a dollar in your pocket? Can you not buy a dozen cans so as not to confuse and delay the checkout line day after day? Oh, and to be sure, he'll buy his lotto. He won't know which one, it's so hard to pick, and he won't be able to choose, and he'll flirt with the girl, and then the additional checks will be proffered, one for each new lotto, until his old checkbook is used and several hours passed, as he leaves with his soup and bingo paper, the first he'll forget to eat, the second which will never win, and nothing will change the fact that he will slip into the line just ahead of us, no matter how long or short we stay." Bim said all this as I passed their conference in the dog food aisle. I am actually not on terrible terms with them, and have a fondness for Bim's curiously distant haranguing, which if it didn't sound as though it were coming from the tin speaker of the store's tannoy system, might be more upsetting. I simply nodded and strolled past, feeling absently for both my leaky pen and the squashed checkbook in my back pocket, hoping they existed in a less miserable way than Bim suggested. The sisters had no cart, and, as I well knew, were themselves at the food hanger, only to purchase a single item. I watched as Emma hoisted the object of their visit, a mattress-sized bag of dog food, which she then dumped over tiny Bim's still-talking head. Bim went silent for a moment beneath the smothering bag as Ima let out a whispery oath, which I took to be the fossil of her laughter. Bim jostled the bag like a dead body until it lay over her shoulders around the peg of her little neck. But before I got away, I heard her say, "In fact, it's easier when it's harder." Meaning that somehow her shopping would be easier now that it had been made much harder by the heavy bag. I repeated this phrase to myself as I passed them, trying to verify its authenticity. Was it true, or just the expression of a tiny, though very mighty, lunatic? But this was one of those bits of philosophy, or potential maxims, that almost refuses to let one in to study it. In fact, it's easier when it's harder. I began to imagine experiments in which such things could be tested. Was it a universal truth, or part of the maniac's creed down at Goose Hollow? Goose Hollow, I should say, is a long-ago defeated camping and recreation park the sisters own, and where the sisters still live, and which, for some reason, perhaps because they plan on opening it again one day, they like to pretend is still in the full flush of business. They still turn on the red neon no vacancy sign every night, and if anyone pesters them, they will insist that the park is full and can take no more campers, trailers, or tents. They also, every weekend, light a bonfire on the metal tower structure that stands atop the brown recreation hall in the middle of the park. Historically, this bonfire would be lit by a happy visiting child by means of a zipline system that consists of a wire connecting the peak of the metal tower to a hitch on top of the gatehouse. Now it is Emma or Bim who slide along the harness on the wire and light the bonfire, as though there are dozens of cheerful weekend campers waiting to be warmed in the cool summer evening. Tall Ima lives in the big Swiss chalet on the hill overlooking the hollow. Round Emma lives in what was, once upon a time, the gatekeeper's cabin sited by the fence. The cabin is surrounded by wide green mats of plastic grass and studded with tiki torches that have somehow been burned entirely black. Aside from the zipline pillar on the roof, the cabin also features a dozen floodlights, which are kept blazing even on the brightest summer day. Bim herself makes a residence in the Brown Fort Recreation Center beneath the metal bonfire tower. Two things are known generally about the sisters. Number one, they are possibly the worst people in the world. And number two, they sometimes try to kill each other and or strangers. It is not uncommon to hear gunfire from Goose Hollow, and there are occasional sightings of Emma standing on the roof of her cabin in the early evening, shining a floodlight around the grounds with a shotgun leaning up her side. If the police are ever involved, the sisters maintain a strict policy of quiet. "They are shooting at the terrible coyotes," they will say, "that have broken into the chicken house." I believe it does me not one jot of credit to admit that I have been one of the few foreign persons permitted to wander, unshot at, inside their bright and desolated hollow. It is not often, and I don't believe they care for me or want me, but bitter politeness, or some pathology of their own, compels them to invite me for a meal at the Swiss Chalet once or twice a year. The source of this compulsion is mysterious to me, but I suspect that the sisters perceive me as a fellow traveller, more accurately, as a lost brother. I am in the feather of their age bracket. I am considered somewhat peculiar and otherworldly, the wizard to their witch, and because in town the Goose Hollow girls and I are occasionally, for convenience sake, lumped together in the category of potentially demented hermits, with me being on the side of kindly dementedness and the girls considered lethally unpleasant and clearly dangerous. And so, in the store, after Bim delivered a monologue on my dawdling checkbook broth can loitering, and just prior to Emma attacking her with the mattress of dog food and the subsequent eruption of wisdom or lunacy in the form of, "In fact, it's easier when it's harder," Bim ordered me to come to the house that evening, under the condition that I leave the food hanger at once and not make any moves toward the checkout line. As they have never cared to listen to any response I have ever provided, I simply continued on my way, a little rapidly, as I hoped to purchase the soup before they achieved the shiny vista point at the end of the dog food aisle, where everything in the store suddenly becomes visible. So yes, I would go, and despite the fact that I have never successfully communicated with them, in fact only received the negative consultations of Bim, the voodoo breezes of Ima, and the final judgment of Emma, I thought to myself that I would go to Goose Hollow and find out, if it was at all possible, what Bim meant when she said what she did.
Something hidden, bright on thoughts and shining like a light forgotten. There's another one here, there's another one here, there's another one here, there's another one here. Found in secret, lost locations, bearing forth in peace and patience. There's another one here, there's another one. There's another one here, there's another one here.
There's another one here. There's another one here. There's another one.
arrived at Goose Hollow, I was somewhat surprised to see the bonfire tower freshly loaded with wood. I hadn't realized it was a Saturday, and found the possibility of having to witness a big fire with the sisters an additional unpleasantness. Nor did I relish the idea of watching an old round woman or an old tiny woman go flying through the air on a zip line with a blowtorch in hand, which was the official method and lighting tool of the bonfire. The gate was unlocked, but yet covered in warning signs as to the gloomy result of trespassing, but I entered casually and began to make my way toward the hill. I assumed we would be dining in the chalet, but instead found the sisters standing in a huddle around the side of the brown fort, trying to light the torch. Although Bim said something nasty about soup cans and made a few general comments on my shoddy appearance, she was most concentrated on the funnel of the torch, which appeared to be malfunctioning. It was perhaps their focus, and the fact that I tended not to look at them as much as possible, that prevented me from noticing until I arrived in their midst, that Bim still bore the burden of the giant food bag over her shoulders. Her tiny apple face strained with exertion, and her old hair shined with sweat, and yet it was the blowtorch that most troubled her. I wanted to point out that the rusty fuselage of the torch canister might finally be, after the hundreds of zipline bonfires, out of propane. But their circle was so tight and boiling that I simply stood quietly and watched as Emma lit a match and Bim strangled the torch and Ima whispered her oaths. As a side note, it was here that a momentary daydream arrived. I was doing my best not to look at the tall icicle of Ima when a peculiar brain movie began to unfold the story that Ima was nothing but a crazy shadow sent to harm the earth with mild curses from a planet made of old dresses, and that further, her sisters were from the same world and had come to retrieve her, but then all of them had utterly forgotten and so stayed on in a heavy, bitter confusion and homesickness. I was roused from the dream of the old dress planet by a distinct crunching noise. I thought at first that Emma had taken the blowtorch nozzle into her mouth in some attempt to chew it back into service. But as I watched, I saw her hand run to a small tear in the roof of the dog food bag on Bim's back. Her fingers danced inside the hole, and she pulled forth a single chunk of charcoal dog food, which she then inserted into her mouth. Ima cursed rather loudly and in retrospect, with what must have been pleasure, as a sputtering green flame appeared at the tip of the torch. "Go," Bim commanded Emma, who at once took the torch into her hands and sprinted toward the gatehouse like a ball of yarn bouncing its way through a swamp. Bim did not directly offer me any of the dog food, but during Emma's dash to the gatehouse began to repeatedly ram the bag into me. During these bumpings, Ima came closer, and while I tend to not listen to her for the whispery consistency of her message, I did finally hear her say four words while she pointed to the bag on her sister's back.
"Fit for human consumption," she said.
I looked closer at the bag. There were a number of images of dogs scattered here and there, but there were additionally quite as many photographs of old people. They sat on benches, they stood in green pastures, each of them grandly hoisting a chunk of stony charcoal dog food into the sky, like manna from heaven. Emerging from the mouths of every happy old person, and even the dogs, was a thought bubble with the words, "Fit for human consumption," boldly inscribed. I had a choice, certainly. I could easily have declined this supper, but I am a naturally curious person and did, when I was a boy, experiment with the variety of foods that might be presented to pets. So I have sampled cat and dog food, both dry and wet, and I have eaten dog biscuits and even tasted the leathery sinew of a dog bone.
so I was curious to see if this cross-possible foodstuff, fit for human consumption, might have been made palatable to the human mouth. Perhaps it would be wonderfully tasty, or had been developed for astronauts. Thus, as Emma went gliding through space above us on the zipline wire, with her blowtorch sputtering green, I selected a bit of coal from the bag and gave it a broad-minded try. I will not belabor the point. It tasted like a compressed chunk of bone with a strong hint of spoiled bacon, a sedimentary taste that I believe may never sufficiently depart my mouth, no matter the regimen of mint, whiskey, and meat that may arrive to do battle with it. As Emma began to apply the blowtorch here and there, and the flames began to shoot wildly into the woodpile like a kind of bright liquid, I suddenly realized that however thoroughly unpleasant the evening was, however revolting in all examinable places, that I had chosen to come here, that as I stood in the vomit bowl of the horrible evening, that I wanted to be here, even as it unfurled in beastliness all around me. There was no denying it. I had not expected a casual evening of truffles and stargazing and board games and cheery philosophy. I could have stayed home in the comfort of my own soup-can sanity. But I had chosen to come here, to be with them, come what may, knowing only that unexpected nastiness awaited. Emma jounced in the harness, pulling herself along the wire, trying to get closer to the flame. "The hand is going in," Emma announced, and she began to fish her fingers around in the yellow blades of the fire. At this somehow important juncture of fire touching, Bim signaled Ima, who went, giraffe-like, over to a small shed. She emerged a moment later with a rifle, whose long cold form, I realized as she dragged it across the dirt, looked a lot like her. "There's an old coyote eating our dog food," Emma shouted down to her sisters, and they all, even Ima, set their wicked eyes on me. In the height of their hostility, I saw their faces soften. They suddenly warmed to me, as a hunter might smile gently when he spies his prey at last. I took Emma's to be the final words of the evening, and I bid them adieu, in the polite expression of my escape, as I commenced my rickety old man's dash for the gate. So it was that as Emma swung her hand in the fire, and Bim loaded the gun, and Ima softly cursed me, that the coyote of myself went racing for the hills. And when that first shot blasted forth, and the dirt splashed up around my feet, I found myself laughing with the madman's joy of escape and the epiphanous thrill that the question I had come to investigate had been answered. And not just now, but long ago and all along in the manner of my own relationship to the world. That I had come to Goose Hollow to be with the sisters was, in its turn, my own way of taking a sack of dog food onto my back to make my shopping harder. Such engagement may not be easier in the way of sleep or rest or peace. But as against adversity and struggle, there arrives the special ease and joy of life itself, the flowing wind of speed and grace and felicity and concentration of self, the unification of intent, as one races away in the mean happy dust of a shotgun blast. And it is suddenly easier because it's harder. All they ever do is ask for you. All they ever do is ask for you. You're hanging from a wire. Put your hand into the fire. Lift yourself a little higher. Not a lot of good, a lot can do. Not a lot of good, a lot can do. When you're hanging from a wire, lift yourself a little higher.
looking for a fire. Thought of something else that we could do. Thought of something else that we could do. Instead of hanging from the wire. Instead of looking for.
Been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void.